Podcast. It's the podcast where I get to sit down and talk with all sorts of interesting people about the movies that help them fall in love with movies. And this week on the podcast is Matthew Price from the Mammal Podcast. If you're not listening to Mammal, then I can list around 10 different things which are probably wrong with you at this point, because Mammal is a great podcast. I mean, I have to admit that I wasn't the most avid listener up until around a year ago. I mean, and then I got to meet this guy at TIFF. He was just fantastic. It was kind of weird. I mean, I don't think I had actually tweeted at him that often. And then one day I was like, I'm going to go see this documentary about all of these track runners on drugs and who's going there. And Matthew Price was there. He was just raising his hand immediately, like, hey, I'm here. And this guy in a Blues Brothers shirt. I'm like, what else do I need to know about a man that's wearing a shirt that has the Blues Brothers on it? One of the greatest movies ever. And yeah, I'm making assumptions there, so I don't know what Matthew actually thinks about the Blues Brothers, but I'm assuming he loves it because he had a shirt of it on. But anyways, this week we get to sit down and talk about Philip Kaufman's film The Right Stuff, which is all about space and myths and men and technology and all, and we get into all of these topics, and it's really great. As usual, this podcast, I don't think I've actually been saying this, but I hope you've all been getting it. This podcast is all encompassing. When we sit down to talk about these films that these people want to talk about, we are going all out spoilers. So please don't send me any hate mail. Don't send me, oh crap, I wanted to watch that. You should see this podcast is up, say I should go watch that movie if you haven't seen it already, and then come and listen to the podcast, and then tell your friends to do the same. As usual, enjoy.
On October 14th, 1947, Captain Charles Yeager shattered the sound barrier, propelled man into the future. And the search began for a new breed of men. Men who were fearless.
You've heard about our project.
Sounds dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
Count me in.
I got a rocket in my pocket and a roll in my wall.
Ambitious.
Who's the best pilot you ever saw? You're looking at it, baby.
Patriotic beyond question.
I just thank God I live in a country where the best and the finest in a man can be brought out.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you America's Mercury Excellence!
Seven men who would risk their lives in a hurtling piece of machinery to cross the threshold of space.
It takes a special kind of man to volunteer for a suicide mission, especially when it's on TV.
So the film you decided to talk about is the 1983 Philip Kaufman film, The Right Stuff, which happens to be about the original U.S. Mercury 7. I always started all of this with, and it's the most obvious question, is can you tell me about the first time you actually watched this film and what happened around that?
Yeah, so this is funny because, you know, I don't always have very site-specific sort of memories of like where I was. I know that I saw this movie in its initial release, so I would have been 12, I guess, or almost 13 years old myself. And so I'm sure that I saw it with my parents in a local Toronto theater. And I know that and I also know that I went back almost immediately and saw it a second time. And it's, we were chatting before we started, it's long. And I'm sure it was, like, probably the longest movie that I had seen up to that point, in the theater. Right? And so what I mostly remember about it was knowing that it was long, but feeling like it just went by really fast. And so I saw it twice when it came out, and then Toronto has, where I grew up and where I live now, Toronto has, probably the first really large-scale IMAX cinema, which is the Cinesphere. And the Cinesphere is a massive IMAX screen. Like, most movie theater IMAX screens are about a half to two-thirds the size of the Cinesphere screen. It's huge. And they used to play 35 millimeter and 70 millimeter prints on that screen. So within a couple of years, I'd gone back and seen it in 70mm on this absolutely gorgeous, massive screen with just really loud. And that screening specifically, I remember even better. And just remember it sort of cementing it in my mind, like, yeah, this is the movie for me.
So you saw it for the first time when you were 13, 14. Were you much of like a space kid?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think are the movies that everybody liked. Like, I really liked Star Wars, and I liked Indiana Jones, and I liked all that sort of, an E.T., I think, had already come out the year before. And so I was, I think, as gravitated towards science fiction or space as really any kid, and I don't think I was more gravitated towards it than other kids. But what I wasn't necessarily really keen on before that movie was history, and specifically the history of the 20th century. And I think that movie really opened me up in that way. And that idea of this sort of myth-making quality that The Right Stuff has about things that have really happened pretty recently. You know, I wasn't really like a World War II movie kid. There weren't really a lot of, you know, especially sort of 78 to 83, you know, except for Apocalypse Now, which I was too young to see. There weren't like a lot of really seminal war films that were sort of mythologizing recent history before this, right? And that I remember thinking what I gravitate towards in The Right Stuff, even more so than the Mercury Astronauts, is that the movie is really about Jaeger. And that Jaeger in the movie is easily my favorite character in a movie, probably of all time. Incredibly enigmatic figure throughout that film. I just remember really strongly connecting with how he was being portrayed, how he's being played, how they photographed him, and how kind of iconic all of his actions were. He's an incredibly sage character in the film that almost functions as a kind of Greek chorus throughout, and really pulls you through thematically in a lot of these areas that the film wants to talk about. And so I think it was more the historical gravitas of it, even more so than the space stuff, that I remember really responding to.
You kind of bring up the idea of Jaeger, and you also talk about your now found interest in history. What's weird about that to me is that Jaeger, and you even said it yourself, is more or less the myth that the movie has given us, this idea of the test pilot who can always push to the envelope. But at the same time, we're also kind of going through this history of what was the beginnings of space technology with America. How do you kind of split or put those two things together as it comes packaged in this film?
Well, you're right when you say that Jaeger operates on the level of myth, but he also, what's amazing about him as a historical figure is he actually did all that stuff. He did things that were, when you watch that movie, they seem impossible. And even like having read the book subsequent to that, you know, some of the things that happen in that film, in the movie version of it, it's not exactly clear what happened. Like, I'm thinking about the scene at the end when I watched the movie, and when there's the explosion as he jettisons the plane, like, it's not clear what happened exactly, other than he was in real trouble and you think he's gonna die. And spoiler, he does not die at the end of the movie. He kind of walks away from this really horrific crash. In the book, it goes into a lot more detail about what happened to him. He was in a pure oxygen suit because the plane he was in, which was designed to set the altitude record, it actually, the way that it operated was, in the nose of the plane, there were these little hydrogen emitters that were essentially designed to work in zero gravity, because the plane was supposed to go so high that regular flight mechanics just would cease to exist. You'd be essentially in the bottom of outer space. And these little hydrogen emitters are essentially supposed to tip the nose back down so that you can descend back towards the Earth. And they failed, and he went into a flat spin. And when he goes into that flat spin and tries to eject, his suit, which is a pure oxygen environment because it's designed to basically go to space, there's a spark, and the oxygen environment causes that spark to turn into an inferno. In the air, his crash helmet fused to his face. That's how hot it was. The plastic melted and ran into his side of his head and had to be, like, removed after he landed. It's the most incredible. And he really did that and then walked away. You know, it's the overarching thing about Jaeger for me is that, and that I think the point of the movie is that it's about the difference and understanding the difference between achievement and fame. Jaeger is purely representative of achievement. He rejects being known. He rejects being paid to do the things he does. He fully understands that it has nothing to do with who knows who he is. It has to do with what he can do. And the flip side of that, which is the Mercury astronauts who, you know, initially, I think sign up for reasons of fame and notoriety and because they feel they are owed some kind of recognition. I think the journey that they go on by the end of the movie is to understand that it is in fact their achievements that are important and not their fame for achieving them. That scene at the end when they're counterpointing his kind of descent to that crazy barbecue is all about them kind of looking around and going, actually, this is more important than whether we are well known or not. Like, there's this kind of realization of what Jaeger has been saying all through the film. It's one of the more powerful metaphors for American society that I think you could really have.
I see where you're going there, but the thing about it that I kind of saw in that, does this at all reduce their own achievements as being the first astronauts of America?
No, I don't. Do you mean in the sense that they are, as the movie keeps saying, they're spam in a can?
Yeah.
I think it gives perspective to those achievements in a way. No, I think that it's an easy and facile thing to say, and Jaeger himself refutes it in the film by saying, monkeys don't know they're on top of a rocket. These guys, they know that. The movie supports this idea that our own cognizance, our own self-awareness of the situations that we find ourselves in, even if we exert relatively little control over their outcome, it's our own recognition of them that actually adds to the heroism. They are very heroic because they understand that they could die. And in fact, they do die. And the character of Gus Grissom, who I think is one of the great sort of tragic figures of modern American cinema, really, the way that the movie portrays his failing and then his ultimate death is just so tragic that he, you know, I don't think it takes away from the heroism at all. And I think, in fact, one of the things that the movie does brilliantly is that it kind of gets to have it both ways. You know, it gets to show these astronauts as regular men and it uses a surprising amount of humor, I think, to kind of get at some of this stuff. There's some, I honestly think there's some of the funniest stuff I've seen in any film has to do with this movie. There's some genuinely hysterical moments in it. Pretty much everything with Goldblum and Harry Shearer
is like gold for me. Like their looks to each other, they're in a very small amount of the film, but they're really funny. And all of the stuff with Shepard sitting, you know, trapped in the capsule and all of that stuff, they get use a surprising amount of humor to like get to the humanity of these guys. And they still can cut to that shot of them walking down the hallway, this like super iconic shot that's been copied in every movie from Armageddon to Monsters Incorporated. They cut to that shot and it is genuinely uplifting to see them. It is impressive when they come walking down that hallway. I believe that movie absolutely mythologizes those guys and humanizes them at the same time.
Was this the film to start that shot of the guy running down the hallway to open the door to be like, oh, the Russians have it too, like Goldblum does?
I don't know.
Every one of those.
I don't know if it's a reference to older films or if it is, in fact, the first movie that does it, but that shot is amazing. I love every time they get to that, it always ends with, oh, we know, sit down. It's just fantastic. Again, one of the things about this that really made an impression on me, that if you think about it, this is a huge epic film. There's like a ton of characters. But every single scene in it is considered in a way that you would normally expect to find in a much smaller film. The transitions between scenes, the way that the scenes, juggle the tone of the film, which is a very tricky order to kind of get that humor and that gravitas and the mythological stuff. And just think about the way that the tone shifts in the kind of opening of the film in Ponchos, when it goes from Olan Jones sitting at the bar making a fool of herself and this really kind of funny and jocular tone, and then it gets out on the desert with that chase, and that desert chase is easily one of the most beautifully photographed scenes of people on horses. Like it's stunning. Right. And it's all within the space of about 5 minutes that Kaufman is able to really juggle these like very, I think they're pretty wide swings throughout that film. And it's a masterclass, I think, in how to have kind of all of these elements, all these balls in the air. There's no aspect of it for me that's not stupendous. The score, the Bill Conti score, is a knockout, I think. It's a genuine knockout. It kills me every time I hear it. I don't think there's a bad performance in it. And there's several that I think are stupendously, like, I can't get over how good Ed Harris is in this movie. He is, like, from another planet half the time. I can't get over how good, even though it's a small part, but how good Mary Jo Deschanel is playing his wife, and how incredibly sort of touching their little story is against this larger backdrop. And I can't get over, when you talk about juggling, how cleverly, you know, this movie, for all of its incredible kind of ensemble aspects, it's still Yeager's movie, and everybody else in it exists to illuminate things about him and what he represents. It's a huge cast and a huge story that spans, you know, 25 years, and yet remains at its core very focused on what it needs to say. Incredibly difficult from a scriptwriting perspective, from a structural perspective, to create scenes that actually all support your main idea. I've lost the thread of where I was going with this, but I think, you know, that is again part of the reason that I just love it so much.
What I kind of noticed when I was watching this, and I have to say this is the first time I'm actually seeing this film, that when the movie begins, when you have that black and white view of the pilot,
voiceover that Yvonne Helm does,
the voiceover talking about the devil who's behind that barrier
that lived in the sky,
and what actually begins our transition into the film is this explosion of the what we assume is the plane having crashed, someone trying to hit that sound barrier. And then we go to this guy who we kind of just assume is some form of a priest or something. I don't think the movie ever actually tells us.
That guy is the Angel of Death.
That's what I was thinking.
Literally the Angel of Death, right? Because he shows up at the astronaut program. I'm like, what is that guy doing there?
I was wondering, was he like family of this other guy? But these guys weren't there in the beginning of the movie. They came later when the sound barrier was broken.
No, he's clearly nominally the chaplain of Edwards Air Force Base, right?
Yeah.
But really, the movie has a very strong, I mean, it's almost, you know, expressionistic in the way they treat that guy. He's a literal Angel of Death. And that initial shot when he walks up to the door and she's just like, go away. Like, it's not even like, oh, what happened to him? She just thinks if she can get him to go away, it won't happen.
It's what you expect in a moment like that. And they kind of tackle it later on, which I love a lot, which is the idea of, for this movie, which is a very male movie, it actually handles all of the female characters in a very nice way, even though for such a short term. When we get this moment where all the wives are together early on, when these new pilots have just come in, and they kind of start to finally talk to each other about their own fears of...
And how, that scene, Veronica Cartwright is really great in that scene. And again, it goes down to this thing where the casting all the way down the line in a really large cast, boy, everybody is really well cast. The women that play the wives of these test pilots and astronauts, you know, they get their due in this film. And without breaking the context of it still being the late '50s and early '60s, you know, it's still, they're not acting out in a way that's not befitting of the time in which they live, but they're still, I think they're being treated with a lot of respect. And the other, female character in the film, Nurse Murch, is also given a lot of shades and a lot of, I mean, she's really like a cartoon when they go to that Albuquerque hospital, right? I mean, it's like a joke. She's got the crazy mustache and she's clearly scary. And, you know, Gordo decides he's going to have sex with her and that's going to solve all his problems. That scene between her and his wife is great. And like all of a sudden you go, oh no, she's just a regular person. She sees right through him.
She just knows to be that kind of a woman so that Gordo will be useless to her.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and again, those scenes are, I mean, they're really funny, and they were copied shamelessly again in Armageddon, those training scenes, or sort of the test, not the training so much, but the testing, where they're deciding whether they're going to be fit to be astronauts or not, you know, shooting them with the electrical needle and all of that. Those scenes are hilarious, and they're quite scatological, like the enema scene is, you know, it's pretty silly. Like, it's almost like Porky's at a certain point, right? It's dumb, but it's really funny. And yet, at the same time, there's a ton of reveals on character in terms of what, you know, why are these guys the ones being selected? What do they innately have? Because there's, you know, 100 or 300 applicants, right? But you immediately embrace the idea like, no, these are the seven. For sure. These are the right guys.
One of the big things that this movie kind of tries to talk about is the media. I mean, there's so many scenes where when the whole idea of the astronauts come around that you just see all this crowd of people with their cameras, with their microphones. And it almost feels like Kaufman kind of just puts in this rabble noise in the background and doesn't actually record them so as to give you this feeling.
I was doing some reading about this because I am fascinated by that group. And I think, again, back to this idea of celebrity or fame versus achievement, I think he wants to make a very strong satirical point about them being really like insects, right? They seem like they swarm place. They don't just go somewhere. They come in a large group and swarm there. So I was doing a little reading on Wikipedia. the people that play the reporters are an independent theater troupe from San Francisco, and they're like an experimental dance theater troupe. They do acrobatics and stuff. And the sound that you're hearing is a mixture of old Nikon cameras being clicked with the sounds of Beatles.
That makes so much sense.
Doesn't it? And it's so awesome. Like, I mean, all the sound design in the movie is amazing. The sounds of the jets, I don't think even, and I played this off of, I don't think there's a Blu-ray of this yet, so I'm just watching this off of regular DVD. Holy moly. The jets sound amazing. I mean, a few of the things this movie did to me, first of all through high school, I chewed Beeman's gum.
I was very curious as to what Beeman was. Like, I guessed it Beeman's, was a gum, but...
Beeman's is gum. It's a mildly peppermint-flavored gum, but it's known as the gum of test pilots.
Mm.
Okay? And you can just get... I mean, Beeman's gum is just available. It's just... It's delicious gum. I would still chew it if I could now. But I definitely chewed Beeman's gum all through high school. Absolutely, between 1983 when I saw this movie and 1986 when Top Gun came out, it definitely let me hate the shit out of Top Gun. Like, I hated Top Gun for taking what I thought were these incredibly noble test pilots and reducing them to a soap opera that I didn't care about. I loathe that movie. For being, and all of the people that go on and on about how great the photography is in Top Gun, the aerial photography, I think it's terrible. Like, awful. Because the right stuff is so much better. It ruined other movies for me. It was so good.
I'm trying not to respond to that right now. Oh, Top Gun, I love you.
Oh, you poor sick bastard. No, I hated it. And that was why, you know?
Because 1986, the year I was born.
Oh, jeez. All right.
I was trying not to make this an age thing.
You know, you can't help it.
I can't.
I can't help, you know. I can't help you on that.
But moving into back into this media thing, and you were right, kind of bringing it back to the idea of celebrity versus achievement. I'm still not sure as a film as to whether it comes down on the side of saying that these astronauts actually deserve their fame over their achievements.
I think, in my opinion, well, first of all, I think the movie is one of the last American films to really follow in. It's sort of, to me, it's more like films from the 1970s than it is like films from the 1980s, in the sense that it does not necessarily point you in the direction of what the answer is. It's not a very heavy-handed or moralistic film. So I would say that you are free to make the decision based on what's presented to you. My personal read on it is that the Mercury astronauts grow to, sort of become more like Yeager rather than Yeager becoming more like them. And that the movie's point of view is that what Yeager represents is a more pure type of heroism.
Oh, definitely. Yeager doesn't change from start to finish.
No, that's right. And that's why I bring up this idea of like a one-man Greek chorus, because, what he represents is so kind of well-developed and unassailable that he doesn't need to change. But, and yet, he still, you know, he still represents the main character in the film. I mean, the movie is about Yeager. And the brilliance of Kaufman is, I think, the easy read, and my understanding is there was an earlier draft of the script for this film, is to say, let's cut Yeager out altogether. It's a distraction and we only have so much time. You know, if the movie's supposed to be about the Mercury program, let's just make it about that. And we'll just focus on the seven Mercury astronauts. Because otherwise, you know, it gets too complicated. But I think Kaufman very smartly understands that without Yeager, the film has no soul. It's not really about anything. It's not really able to comment on things in such an effective way. It then just becomes, you know, hey, geography. And I think this is so easily could have been that, you know, how many of these, like, you know, horrendously banal biopics do we have to sit through where people are just put on this pedestal and their lives are, you know, merely enacted so that we can be just, you know, in awe of their greatness, as opposed to saying, no, their lives are great, but the reason to make a movie about them is because we want to make a commentary on their context and how they, you know, how they exist in the culture. And there's just so much more depth to the approach that this film takes with Yeager than there would be without him.
That's very true. I can't see what this movie would be if they had cut out Yeager. Like,
it would be Ray, but there would be seven of them.
Oh man, one of the things that I kind of noticed, and this keeps going back to Yeager, and it's kind of a weird thing that even though we spend so much time away from Yeager, the film, as we said, still comes back to him at the end. And it kind of feels really weird when we start out where we're talking about test planes that they're running where they have to be catapulted from another bigger plane, to then at the end of the film where we're now into the jet era where he can take off on his own and do all of these amazing things. But yet we're still talking about a character who travels by horse, right? And he lives in this small town where technology doesn't seem to be that much of a discussion point. But in a film which is entirely about technology, where did it draw you in your thoughts as the technological revolution continued?
Yeah, you're totally right. And I think, you know, the movie makes a lot of points about, really, again, quite funny points about, you know, our German scientists are better than their German scientists. And you know, talking about this idea of technology as the sort of main driver of, you know, that's the thing. The pilots, the astronauts, are or could have been totally peripheral to what was happening, right? The real reason the whole thing exists at all is because of propulsion engineers, and not because of test pilots. But there is this idea that in order for the whole thing to be a success at all, that human personality and human drive is necessary. And I think it comes down to the reason that they want to show Yeager as this kind of a person who's almost out of time. You know, he's away from time in a way, like he does not change. You're right, he rides horses. He's this very kind of stoic, almost Old West figure who just happens to be able to get in, you know, strap rockets to his back and fly as fast as a man has ever gone. Is almost the same reason that they're able to say, you know what makes these birds go up? Funding makes these birds go up. You need people to make this real. You know, all the technology in the world won't get funded if there aren't people there who we care about, we want to succeed. And the scientists know they're not the guys. You know, they're not.
The frustration on the scientist's face the moment that a person comes to them and say, look, I want to see outside and be able to pull the ejection button if I have to, because I don't trust you, scientist.
And not just that they don't trust them, but it's such a palpable shift of power, you know, when they go, well, who are you going to get? You know, that, like, that scene with the scientist and the scene with Glenn's wife where she won't talk to Johnson, both of them really show, like, no, you've really made it so that we actually are in charge in a weird way. If we don't do this, then it won't mean anything. You know, you've created these mythic celebrity people who we are now supposed to play. You know, that the Henry Luce, who's the publisher of Life magazine, says, you know, someone will write your life story and it'll be under your byline. So they're essentially, they don't do this in the movie, but I remember one of the things I really stuck out in the book was that the people at Life magazine, when they were posing them for the pictures, they taught them how to hold their hands on their hips. Because men hold their hands on their hips with their thumb facing back towards their butt. And if you put your hands on your hips the other way with your thumb facing forward, you don't look right. And stuff like that, like they were put into these, almost like these roles, and they were told like, okay, act this out. Be this iconic thing that we need you to be. And once they were that iconic thing, they actually, all the power transferred to them. The movie is also, I think, as much about the power of symbols as anything, right? That by being symbolically important, they gain genuine importance. And that it transfers it from that celebrity idea back to achievement.
I mean, I keep bringing back to it, but that barbecue scene where there's this moment where Gus is with Dennis Quaid, and
Gordo,
Gordo, and he makes a comment where he's like, steaks just like at Poncho's.
Yeah, just a few more trimmings. Right?
Yeah, I mean, we broke your record. We got a free steak.
That's right. And that, you know, that scene contains that really important thing where he finally, someone asks him, who's the best test pilot you ever saw? And he almost talks about Yeager. And I think at the time that I saw it, I think I sort of remember, like, my initial understanding of that scene was that he gets, he thinks that he's losing the crowd, so he brings it back and makes a joke out of it. But the more I think about it, the more I feel like he abandons that line of answering out of respect. You know, out of a kind of deep respect for the fact that Yeager doesn't really want to be known in that way. That it would almost diminish him.
That's actually very interesting because as I said, this is my first time watching it, and I definitely had that reading that it was partly that I felt the media was pushing him to give the quick joke response and make it fluffy for the newspaper so that they have a nice headline. Gordo thinks he's the greatest pilot in the world.
Yeah.
And part of it was that Gordo, as you said, kind of felt he was losing the media and would therefore turn out to be the lesser of the seven in the public's eye. But yeah, that might be very true that he wanted to let Yeager be theirs and not for the world, because it's a very interesting thing we find out in the world where we have these small things in our lives where when it's ours, it's our little thing, which could be something as tiny as a piece of paper, as big as someone in your life. It's this tiny thing, but when it becomes something that the entire world knows about and the entire world beloves, it kind of diminishes its own value for you.
Well, you don't own it anymore, right?
Right. And that would have been Yeager in that moment.
Yeah. And he's actually, again, just like a nice little tip of the hat, Yeager's actually in the film. I don't know if you noticed that.
No, I didn't. Like, the real-life Yeager.
The real-life Chuck Yeager is the guy at Poncho's that mops up.
Oh, okay.
Old guy.
I did not see that, no.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of moments where it's sort of like a little head nod to that, where he kind of, like, I think at one point he just tells the recruiter from NASA, like, you want to get out of the way or something like that. And it's like this little, like, nice moment for him, you know, because he was he's the technical advisor on the film. And so all of that stuff, like the other thing about that movie that really, because I fell in love with him so hard, and sort of the idea of him, you know, I've been to Washington D.C. the Air and Space Museum, which is a part of the Smithsonian and is stupendous, and everyone in their life should go. But most people go and are really impressed with the capsules and the moon stuff and all of the NASA equipment that they have there. But they have the Bell X-1, Glamorous Glennis. They have it there. And I'm telling you, I choked up. Like I came around a corner and it's hanging in the air near Amelia Earhart's plane. And I almost lost it.
Wow.
Like that idea of that plane specifically, because you genuinely were getting, you know, he put himself into that airplane at a time when it wasn't like, I mean, there was genuine disagreement. People absolutely thought that if you exceeded the speed limit, you would die. The sound barrier, you would die. You would die.
You see it in the scene where he actually does it, where they finally break the sound barrier and they hear that noise. And because they've never heard it before, they all just go, oh, he died.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's brilliant, again, brilliantly handled. But you know, that you would, like, nobody knew for sure what would happen, right? And he straps himself into that thing and says, all right, well, we'll find out. I mean, it's that kind of, again, it's back to the idea of, you know, self-knowledge and being self-aware is what defines being heroic. It's, you know, if you take an action without any knowledge of the danger that that action might produce, that's not actually heroism.
In my mind right now, I'm just flashing back to the Rock scene in, you know, 911, where he basically says the same thing. And I hate that I'm degrading this movie discussion into the Rock in Reno 911.
You jerk.
But that is totally correct. Like it, like how you say in that one moment where people are continually trying to say that these seven men are pretty much monkeys, where they don't do anything, but it's something to know that you're on top of strapping yourself to a rocket, yeah, where it could just fucking blow the hell up.
Yeah. And in fact did many times before they went up.
Like, you can see the sweat coming off of that guy's face who's pushing the button.
The dude pushing the button is hysterical. Again, there's so many bits that are so funny in this movie. The thing with the montage of all the water when Shepard has to pee.
Oh, yes,
I had a little accident when he overfills the coffee cup. Oh, you know, Bob, Alan had four cups of coffee this morning. So odd. You know,
that blew my mind. I'm like, holy shit, what's going on right now?
And I've imagined it from other movies, but like there's that one moment when the guy comes out of the bathroom and the bathroom is like behind a giant wall of electronic like computer equipment. And there's something just hysterical about that. Like that there's all these like tape drives and like high end, you know, digital equipment from the late 50s. And then there's like a bathroom. Right? Like, it's very bizarre. It seems like a weird place to put the restroom.
Like, part of me wants to feel that these are real things happening, and not that this is in his head, he's imagining all of these things because he really needs to go to the bathroom.
No, I think it's both. Yeah. Again, you know, and between that and like, the sign, which that was a real thing too, the sign in the capsule that said no handball playing.
Yeah.
That's a legit, that's a real thing. Glenn apparently put that sign in there as a joke.
So this is a film that came out 30 years plus ago.
Thank you. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And you talked about how seeing it later in life, you even watched it recently for this. How has the movie changed for you over the years, from viewing one to viewing, I don't even want to guess what number at this point.
So I think at this point I'm probably up to about 25 viewings of that film. Something like that. It's among the top repeated films for me, for sure. I think my appreciation of it hasn't. So like I said, there's been a couple of key moments where I feel like I've gotten new insight into what the motivations of the characters might be.
But what I find more exceptional is that I'm still able to strap in and feel just that same exact sense of elevation from watching it that I always did, that I did when I was 12. And that the humor in it still makes me laugh, that the beats in that movie still hit me pretty much as hard as they did the first time. It's not so much that my opinion has changed. There's other films that I really love where I love them and my understanding of them has radically altered through multiple viewings. Like I'm thinking about a film like 6 Degrees of Separation, where my feelings on it now and my understanding of what the story is now are radically different from the first time I saw it. And all to the betterment of it. This is more like the feelings that I have just kind of get amplified. I'm just so amazed and appreciative that a movie like The Right Stuff even exists and that it can be as just as perfectly on for me and hit me as square as the film hits me.
We've mentioned previously small things like Armageddon or Top Gun, movies that have all kind of touched on topics that are equal parts.
Let's be clear. The scenes in Armageddon, which let's call it pay homage to this movie, are by far the best scenes in Armageddon. They're probably the only good scenes in it, right?
I have a little childlike love of Armageddon, but I'll agree with that. I know my child.
Movie, and they're a copy of another movie, right?
These are all movies which, as we say, in parts they kind of equate to moments or elements of The Right Stuff. Over the time from The Right Stuff to now, have there been any movies that you would think of building on what The Right Stuff kind of gave us? That you appreciate?
I certainly don't think Apollo 13 would exist without it. And I think that there's aspects of Apollo 13 where they attempt to improve upon it in certain technical ways. And of course you have the weird dichotomy of what's his name? Playing Gene in Apollo 13 and then playing John Glenn. Now I've lost my mind. I can't remember his name, but Ed Harris. That you have the same actor sort of running through the two films. But there's these very deliberate attempts in Apollo 13 with computer graphics to say, well, now instead of showing the rocket taking off from the ground in its traditional way, we're going to swirl the camera all the way around it as it takes off, and we're going to show you up close what all that would look like using a lot of very sophisticated computer modeling. And we're going to show you, we're going to do a lot more stuff with weightlessness because, for a movie about space, The Right Stuff has no scenes of zero gravity in it. Right.
Well, even if they did, the zero gravity that you would have experienced at that point in that tight, confined capsule wouldn't really be the equivalent of what we see in movies.
Exactly.
Today.
Yeah. But I mean, even in the scenes with Glenn where he's orbiting and you have the sparks going around the spacecraft, They sort of trick it up. Like he holds the camera, he never lets it go and lets it hang there. There's no real scenes of any kind of attempt at showing zero gravity. So they make these sort of, quote unquote improvements on it, which I think, again, they're different stories and I think it's appropriate. I like Apollo 13 a great deal. I think it's very good, A-. Sort of much more straight ahead American film. And I think that actually what it is what The Right Stuff would have been if you had removed the Jaeger parts, and just focused on the Mercury 7. That's kind of how Apollo 13 plays for me. It's more straightforward. It doesn't comment as directly on American culture, but it sort of more focuses on just the astronauts and what kind of people they were and it has this different structure with the ticking clock of the actual mission, right? But certainly that movie doesn't exist without The Right Stuff. It's in some ways it's a reaction to it. I'm trying to think of what else. I think there's a lot of other films that in small ways, one of the things that The Right Stuff gets so right is a male ensemble acting, which is
now become kind of the forte of really, like, I'm thinking of, like, films by David Mamet. And I don't know if those films are necessarily influenced. Mamet was already working prior to that Kaufman's coming out. But David Mamet's films and Barry Levinson's films, the great ones, both have large casts of men interacting with each other in ways that I find endlessly kind of entertaining, right? So that's certainly, like, I think a movie like Good Morning Vietnam kind of owes a little debt to the interplay and the right stuff.
You mean as in the whole comedic side of it?
Just the way that dudes are with each other when there are no women around. Like, okay. There's a certain, like, the scene in the locker room where he's like, let's all keep our wicks dry, gentlemen, that has a certain rhythm. There's a certain kind of very authentic cadence to that scene. And the best of those male camaraderie films kind of get that cadence. Tin Men gets it. I think Levinson was probably already good at it. But, you know, Mamet's films like Glengarry gets that cadence really, really strongly. There's just that sense of, like, when men are together in the absence of women, there's a certain dynamic that sort of takes hold.
I always like to give credit to The Odd Couple for things like that.
Oh, the card table scenes in The Odd Couple are certainly a part of that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I'm not saying that Kaufman invented it by any means, but I think it's a great example of it, how to do it well, right? I can't think of too much else. I mean, I think certainly in the way that he uses the sound mix, I have that film was influential because it's a very, very wide sound field, and it really pushes the limits of how loud you can make the movie. And I think, you know, even Raiders and E.T. and Empire, which had already come out, and I guess that was the same summer that Return of the Jedi came out. Even they are not quite so aggressive sometimes in their sound, right? And subsequent to that, I think that became okay to sort of have that really aggressive, really loud kind of effect soundtrack going.
You mentioned it when you were talking about the visual nature of this film, and I guess this is something I kind of forgot to talk about because it struck me when I was watching it that every time that it reached a technological feat, when we got to the speed of sound, when we got to Mach 2, when we got Ed Harris in the capsule orbiting the Earth, we always got these visual moments of how the pilots were conceiving their what they were doing at that point. And it was very much kind of felt kind of like what Kubrick was doing to the end of 2001 in that crazed psychedelic moment, where you kind of don't even feel that this is reality that they're seeing, that this is beyond what humans should be able to perceive.
Well, there's definitely a very strong Kubrick influence in the way the film is directed, for sure. There's a very strong influence in terms of how things are designed to look. Like the scene where they actually walk over to see the capsule, I think, is they're walking through NASA, and in the backdrop are these massive structures that don't look like regular buildings. They're like these crazy conical structures and stuff. And you can't help but think of Kubrick when you see stuff like that, right? Even the scene, I weirdly think that the scene with the chimp in the centrifuge is very Kubrickian to me. Like, there's something about there's a look on the chimp's face as he spun through that centrifuge, like, it's just bizarre, right? And it feels surreal when you watch it.
In space.
Oh yeah, monkeys in space. You can't get better than that. And you're right, the scenes in orbit with those, and again, that's something that is, you know, it is documented that he saw these weird particles. But for Kaufman to make this leap to say, we're going to connect this to this aborigine on the ground who's an astral traveler and a shaman, and we're going to make this really explicit connection to the sort of spirituality of spaceflight, it's, you know, it shouldn't work. It should pull you out of the movie. You should be going, what are you, nuts? this guy's on the ground with a big fire, and that's supposed to be, but it works. It just works. I don't know why. You just buy it. Like, yeah, maybe that's what's happening. You know?
I totally forgot about the Australia moment. It was so weird when I saw it come up on the screen. We're now in Australia. I'm like, what the fuck are we doing in Australia?
Yeah, because of the way radio works, right? But like David Gopalil, who's the lead actor from Walkabout, is the main Aussie Aborigine, right? The one who says, oh, that guy over there, like the one that talks to him?
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's a really well-known Aboriginal actor, right? And it's just, it's like it all of a sudden it becomes like it feels like this totally authentic Australian movie for that couple of minutes, you know? And you should, on a logical level, reject that scene. Like, this makes no sense. This is, but it somehow, it makes it better. Like, he just understands that there can be these almost, already non-linear leaps of just emotional logic that can take hold in the film. And because you're dealing with something so large, like traveling to outer space is such a crazy idea to begin with, you will just go along with some of this stuff.
I always like to ask everyone this question because I feel like this moment that we talk about, this moment that we have where movies transform into something else for us, It changes us. It makes us into a different kind of movie watcher.
Totally.
How did this, what changed about you day number two after having seen this film for the first time and had that moment? What changed about what you looked forward to watching?
I think the main thing that the movie taught me, which I think, everyone learns at a certain point, the idea that movies were not accidental, that everything I watched had been considered and was deliberate. You know what I mean?
Yeah, very much.
There was this real sense that like in the, that a movie could be greater than by being more considered and thought out, and that because the scenes themselves were so finely crafted and put together and were so clearly meant to be considered by the audience in a certain way each time, it seemed obvious to me that someone had really, really spent time thinking about every single moment of the film. And, you know, at 12 years old, I think that was a fairly big realization. And it really did change. It changed how I ingested film, but it certainly changed what I gravitated towards, right? It put me on a path, I think. There's still films now that sense of being totally managed by a film, totally, you know, on some level, totally manipulated and held as an audience member, have your attention held with great care throughout the whole film, is still the thing that I think takes hold of me when I really respond really strongly to something.
So what were some of the kind of films that you were looking forward to afterwards? Like, was there a kind of movie that you were, or was it just a more general broad stroke of being able to understand this is something that was considered for me?
Yeah, I don't think it was subject matter based as much as it was stylistic, right? So I think, I certainly started being more interested in, seeing films from other countries and sort of, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to really pinpoint because, it's as you say, 30 years ago. but I'm sure that, it led me towards, sort of more deeply appreciating films where all of the elements of the film were tightly controlled. So, for instance, I love movies that feel artificial in the sense that they feel completely constructed, right? And I'm much more sort of gravitated towards what you would call expressionism in film, like the idea that you would the ideas of expressionism where feelings are made manifest through design and through outward appearance of things, again, played a big, became way more important to me because of how, and I don't think that The Right Stuff is in and of itself particularly expressionistic, but it is exceptionally considered, and all of the ways in which people are photographed, the angles and the sort of all of the depictions of everything in it lead up to, you know, evoking feelings in the audience, right? So I think that, if I have to start naming specific films, it's going to be difficult. But that idea, that underlying idea, like, I'm responding more to a kind of the totality of design in the film. I'm sure I can name a dozen films that have that totality, but it's just that sort of overarching sense of what I was watching.
Okay. For a film that's this aged over the years, we talked about movies like Apollo 13, which kind of built on what it started with. Do you get a feel watching it today that if this was a movie released today, it would be received any differently, or even to the question of if it would be constructed any differently?
I'd like to think that it wouldn't be constructed differently. I think it would need to be paced differently just because tastes change more than anything. Scenes would probably not go on as long. And I think, and it wasn't a huge success at the time it came out. And I don't think it would be a huge success now either. I mean, I think, it has a kind of, fierce intelligence to it that probably, requires enough investment from the viewer that the film in its form now is probably never going to connect with everyone, right? But then you look at a film that did connect with everyone, like a movie that at the time connected with everyone, back to E.T. And I just watched E.T. recently, and that thing is bizarre. Like, I don't know if you've watched that recently, but that movie does not play like a regular movie. It's weird. And so maybe it would connect. I don't know. I mean, E.T. is like impressionistic and weird. There's no sense of like what's happening in it. It's amazing to me that it was the widest hit of all time, right?
It is an amazing movie.
It is, but it's like a Pablo Neruda poem or something.
It's so, all right, on a side note, to drag into E.T., because that's a film that I adore, right? But I hadn't seen it since I was like a young child up to a few years back. And I watched it only to accidentally get a copy of the remastered version with all of the, guns, you know?
Yeah.
And it was really weird to me. And then now I now bought the new Blu-ray that came out like last year, where they finally give us the theatrical version re-restored. And having in my mind the remastered version where Spielberg kind of put in a little extra cuts here and there of E.T. running around in CG. Watching it now, you can kind of see where he did it intentionally to try and help the viewer understand what was going on in the movie. And it wasn't really like a Star Wars story where it was, he wanted to have extra special, pretty looking things going on.
What I'm saying, you talk about whether a film can come forward in time or not. And I think even if you had perfect modern effects for E.T., if that movie was intact in its style, there's no way it comes forward.
Yeah.
I mean, it's lightning in a bottle, right? I feel like The Right Stuff has a better shot of, if it was released today, it still might get, pretty much the exact same reception.
Well, I mean, we're talking about a film that received, I think it was 4 Academy Awards and like
it did,
four
but no,
other
it,
nominations.
It got 10 nominations, it received 4 awards, but it didn't get any of the major awards, because most of those, I think, went to Terms of Endearment, right?
Yeah.
Also a film about an astronaut. And it didn't, I still feel like it's one of those things that people have sort of, they've missed. The other thing, Roger Ebert named it the second best film of the 1980s after Raging Bull. And I would, actually reverse those two. For me, it's the best film of the 1980s. Because having seen Raging Bull and really enjoyed it, I have no desire to ever go back and see it a second time. Like, I think I got all of it. But in the case of The Right Stuff, I can literally go back an unlimited number of times. So
the last thing I want to ask is, for what is it you would tell people who are possibly going to be experiencing this film for the first time? How would you try and sell them or prompt them?
Well, first of all, if you've listened to this, that's a mistake. I've given everything away. It's bad. Don't do that. All right. Now, assuming I'm speaking to them and they haven't listened to this, yes.
Oh, they know that this is going to be all encompassing.
I think the only advice that I have for this film is it is long. Make sure you are well provisioned, fed and watered, as it were, that you're not going anywhere.
Not four cups of coffee.
Don't bring your phone into whatever venue you're going to be watching it in. Don't have any distractions. Turn it up really loud. Put it on the biggest screen possible. And then just enjoy it, because it is just enjoyable. It's, you know, it's back to that thing about Citizen Kane. It's not like Citizen Kane is this great movie, but it's also kind of fun to watch it. It's not hard to watch Citizen Kane. It's not hard to watch The Right Stuff. It's not a chore. It's a movie with, you know, a lot of entertainment value. It doesn't slog through history. It prances nicely through it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Matthew Price.
Thank you, Brad.
So yeah, that was the podcast. It was great to talk to Matthew Price. You can find all of his stuff over at mamo.ca. He does the Mamo podcast. He has a very important person's podcast, a very important dudes and dudettes. You should definitely go and check those out. The last episode, which was on Bruce Willis, was really great. And Mamo, that's a podcast which, like, he just gets up and does stuff. Like, you'll see some that come out twice a week. You'll see some weeks where you'll be like, eh. And him and his co-host, just great people. Hopefully I'll get Matt Brown on this show eventually. I have plans for that. If Matt, if you're listening to this, we'll work out your time for sure. As always, you can listen to this podcast through iTunes. It's on my website over at gmanreviews.com, and you can hear it via Stitcher now. It's over on the Stitcher network, if you're into that kind of thing. The next podcast of this will be up on April 28th, Sunday. I hope you look forward to it. And as always, leave me comments, leave me reviews, leave me ratings through iTunes, on the website, on the post. I think Stitcher has a thing where you can upvote things, so go and do that. And just generally, if you feel the need, send me an email. I'm andrew.robinson@gmanreviews. That's my email. My Twitter is @GmanReviews. You can send me a comment, just anything you like. I always like to hear feedback. So thanks so much for listening, and have a good day, have a good week, have a good... I hope you're having a good time right now. Good day. In my pocket and a fuse.